I welcome, most of you are back from at least one other session, but if you're brand new, how many of you are here for the first time today? Oh, great, nothing's better, because you've come on the day of the final exam. And all those dreams you've had for years, where you woke up never having attended the class, and you're racing to the final, you're going to just add to the mix. It's a collective final. We're going to do some what I like to call soul work, and it's always best to do that together. I'm Patricia Lull, and tomorrow I'm going to head out on the early bus, and a couple of days later I'll be back in St. Paul, Minnesota, where I'm privileged to serve as the bishop for the St. Paul Area Synod. And it's a delight. This is my second visit to Holden Village. It's been a delight not only to make it here, to enjoy everything here, but to be in your presence at meals, many of you, or in little side conversations, certainly at worship, but also in these couple of times that we've been together for this learning opportunity. Let me say a little bit about the theme, and then we're going to go through, I hope, enough of a concise summary introduction for those of you who think you came for the fire film to realize it's not the fire film, but you're going to like this topic as well. The name of this is Against the Grain, Vocation in a Time of Resistance. And as I said on the very first day in introducing myself, I've long been interested in vocation. I think my vocation is to help not only individuals, but institutions find their vocation and claim it and live their way into it. And so having a topic related to vocation seems, it fits with every theme Holden has ever had. You can always go forward with vocation as a topic. But then following the election in the fall, even before November, like so many of you, I think probably all of you, that heightened polarization in our country, we were kind of either shut down and silent or we were shouting at each other. And I realized that that was a different time. We've had close elections in more recent years, but something different was bubbling up in local communities and statewide conversations and certainly nationally. So I added the phrase, in a time of resistance. And for each one of us, that's going to have a slightly different meaning depending upon where we see ourselves in the kind of current arrangement of values and leadership and power and hopes and dreams for our local community as well as our country and our world. So I don't want to hone in too tightly with my own political agenda. I often wake and try to figure out what it is day by day, but rather to invite you to think about your deepest sense of vocation. And because it's Friday and at least I'm heading home tomorrow, to really think about work for the way home. And a quote from Daniel Berrigan, I have most of it up there. Daniel Berrigan back in the 70s, folk hero for many of us of a certain generation. Berrigan's quote is, in spite of all, what will we do with our lives? So not ignoring the conflicts, the polarities, the challenges around us, but fully acknowledging them, each one of us, particularly if we define ourselves out of a core of faith, have to figure out what will we do with our lives. That's the vocational question we're going to take home. But let's see if we can help. I think five or six of you were kind enough to come on this Friday afternoon, come for the first time. Let's do a quick wrap-up of not everything we covered, but what I like to think of as a number of tools. Some of the tools I have confidence that we mastered well enough to use, and others I kind of held them up and I said, here's a tool, goodbye, the bell's ringing, time to go elsewhere. So if it seems a little fuzzy, it does to me as well. One of the tools is this whole concept of vocation. And I want to ask those of you who've been here on a couple of sessions, or if you just walked in today, when you hear vocation, what are some of the aspects of that that you're going to remember as you, when the time comes for you to leave Holden Village? Vocation, what's it about? What could you say about vocation?
Calling.
Calling. And usually calling from one greater than just us. It might be a community call that we would sense for the good of our community, called forward into some action or some particular role, but for, in many, many faith traditions, a calling from God. Okay? Anything else about vocation? Please, Ruth.
What I'm shaped for?
Yeah, say a little bit more about that, because you're a physical trainer, so shape, I think, means something. There's a discipline we talked out about over four scoops of ice cream last night.
We all have things that we're more drawn to, mm-hmm. we're more passionate towards, and I think those interests kind of lead us towards a direction.
So as you describe it more, what I hear in that is there's something very personal about it and unique. Each person has a vocation, but it's unique to them. Meredith, what else would you add?
I'd say it's a continuing struggle to discernment,
mm-hmm.
or at least for me.
You and Joan Chittister, for those of you who just got the packet today, she has a two-page article where she talks about some of the lifelong evolving different questions of vocation and discernment of one's vocation, getting it figured out. Anybody else want to add something about vocation?
You can have more than one.
What do you mean by that? You're right, but what do you mean?
I think it can change for you over your lifetime, and I think you can also have more than one at a time.
Vocation is a very, in many ways a very elastic term, so it's not in some societies, even today, people are locked into a particular role lifelong by their gender, by their caste, by their social location. But living in, particularly in this country, there's a lot of fluidity to how we might live out our deepest calling. Bill.
People who see their job is also a vocation, I think, unfortunately.
That do, where they come together. They aren't necessarily the same, one's job and one's vocation. Sometimes you have to go against the grain. You may be cast in work or in some roles that aren't quite your deepest you, but where it comes together, what a great joy. Yeah. So that's vocation. On the very first day, we read three stories, and those of you who are new will find a text from Matthew's Gospel. It's about Matthew the tax collector, Jonah, and Jeremiah. Those of you who've been here all week, what is, are there some, could you name the common threads in those three stories? I'm sorry?
They all changed directions.
They all changed directions, and they were all a bit resistant. I mean, there was something about the call from God, or when Jesus said to Matthew the tax collector, come and follow me, he had to give up his old life to take on a new life. And I'm particularly fond of Matthew the tax collector in that he gave up a very comfortable job. And that shows a lot of courage, that urgency of hearing the call from Jesus directly to come and follow. Jonah, in his own way, was asked to do something impossible and ran away from it as fast as he could. It was a political calling to go to Nineveh, to this great city of the empire, and tell them to repent. He knew he had no hope that he could succeed in that mission, that it would be a radical expression of God's foolishness, and so he fled in the other direction, but eventually ends up in Nineveh. And he was absolutely right. It was an impossible thing to do because the city so quickly repented. What's a prophet to do when your field disappears before you? And Jeremiah, who there could be many, many weeks on Jeremiah. Jeremiah was the prophet, too young to be a prophet. That was his excuse early on when God called him. I'm just a youth. You can't imagine that I would do this work. He lived out a lot of things in sort of high drama ways. I think he might be one of the patron saints for Holden Village, where there's a lot of wearing of costumes and living out ideas and embodying ideas. But in Chapter 32, right as the enemy army is encamped outside the city walls, ready for the siege to begin, the word of God comes to him through a cousin, kind of interrupts his life, saying, you need to buy this land in the middle of the city. And really, I think that's a provocative one today. In our country, where we have some cities, some places that are really ideal for people to locate and live, and we have other places that we say, well, that's so off the grid, or I was using the example of Flint, Michigan. Who would buy a home in Flint, Michigan these days? Well, a Jeremiah would buy a home there. You'll find also in the packet a half-filled-in chart. It comes from H. Richard Niebuhr. It's simply an illustration of different ways that people relate their faith, in this case Christian faith for Niebuhr, and the culture. And then, I don't know, maybe I did this because I thought identity could tie in, and I believe it does, but also they're just great essays. If you haven't gotten to all the biographical, autobiographical essays in the packet, I commend you to take them home and read them. There's much, much, much good writing from an expanded spectrum of young authors and sometimes authors of goodly age writing about their deepest identity. I want to come back to something I said about Jim Didis right at the end of Wednesday's session, because I don't think I said it as clearly as I could. First of all, the book Bias and the Pious, which makes reference to the film A Time for Burning, I located that congregation that surveyed there in St. Louis, but it's actually Omaha. So my apologies to St. Louis. It's Omaha. One of you helped me remember, corrected me on the city, where people in the 60s were interviewed about their religious faith, but also their racial bias, their racial prejudice. And Didis's claim is a little more nuanced, I think, than I put before you. And you can read it for yourself in this book called Bias and the Pious. Religious faith can be a tremendous asset for helping us grow up into our full maturity, naming our racism, repenting of it, and moving beyond it. Religious faith really can be one of the best motivators for that move toward greater openness. If we allow our religious faith to be transformative, if we think religious faith simply holds us in to a set of values from which we never stray, we let no other dialogue enter in, that's the kind of tightening or narrowness that Didis is talking about, and I think I kind of smooshed that all together. So a big plus for religious faith, if it leads to transformation, a kind of openness to other people, but it's the cause of a kind of narrowness if it simply makes us more defensive in the presence of people with other views. And maybe at another time, at another holding year, we can talk more about that whole nature of prejudice, or one of you could help lead those sessions. Well, we're going to do some work. And now, even if you just walked in a few minutes ago, you have the four tools, or somebody around you has those tools. What I'd like to do is I'm going to go to the board, and the question I want to record your answers is the question, what ails our country these days? And probably we could also expand that, what ails our world. But let's focus just on our own national life these days. What ails us? If this is a time of resistance, what's that about? What are the issues? What are the challenges that we've got to come to terms with to get back on course as a country?
You want us to just popcorn?
Yep, I want you to.
Fear.
Fear. And you want to say fear of?
Fear.
Just fear of. We'll leave that open. Okay. Another thing, something that ails us as a country.
Arrogance.
Arrogance. Okay? And there's somebody right against the wall who wants to.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I don't know it's really possible to separate what ails our country from what ails ourselves.
Okay, fair enough.
The conversation is, I think that maybe kind of one of the same, mm-hmm. so a lot of these things can also be.
Very fair point. We are the nation. And the nation is us, and it's back and forth. It's personal as well as national life. Do you want to add something about an issue or a challenge that's facing us?
Both those, I think, are things that I struggle with personally, but also how to live out faith mm-hmm. in our country, and what part of faith is political, what part of faith is activism.
Okay. I'm going to use my preferred language, which is how to live faith in public life. But your word political, that conveys it too. What else? Big issues, challenges, please.
I would say economic inequality, which is both a fear of and arrogance.
Uh-huh.
Two things all combined.
As part of that economic inequality is greed.
So if we explored why there's economic inequality, what we're going to hit is also dealing with greed. Please.
Alternate realities.
Yeah. Say a little bit more so I know how to spell it up here.
Yeah, in my life, I never, we groups of people understand truth, but understand different things to be true. And I'm not just talking about different points of view. But that they're actually, you know, the whole idea of, you know, alternate facts, or that we perceive really different things to be true, mm-hmm. and not even a common agreement on what actual things have happened.
Some of the public intellectuals have been saying for more than a decade that the center no longer holds, and I think this is an example. People are just talking past each other. They're not exactly living the same reality. They're seeing many, many, many things from a different perspective. Okay.
And media is part of it too. I mean, that people don't. That there's not there's no longer Walter Cronkite, or there's no longer somebody that 75% of the people say that's the news and that's what happened.
You know,
that has disappeared.
Which ties in with the lack of trust.
Okay, I'm going to get that up there by fear, please.
Without at all disagreeing with the individualistic focus, there's also sort of a corporate focus going on that's sort of this heightened sense of boundaries. So we sort of create something that's different than the sum of its parts.
Do you mean that of corporations or
no,
common life?
Common life.
And not everybody's in this common would imply we were all in the same life, but I think what you're saying is there's more than one common life.
Yeah, and the boundaries are really, really high.
Yeah. Well, the good thing is we have some more of the board to fill in, so let me come to Janet, and then I'll sweep right across the room. Please.
That's scarcity mentality.
What do you mean by that?
Like no matter how much we have, we're always afraid. So it ties in with fear, but it's not enough for that. We're worried that you know, we're going to lose it, or that someone else is going to get more.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Comment across the room, please.
I would say feedback on a couple of those other things. Self-righteousness. You had a quote the other day that said that politics without compromise mm-hmm. is merely theater. There mm-hmm. seems to be no compromise. Both sides thinking that they're right and the other side is evil. And I am an old man. I've never seen this kind of divide in our country to this extent.
Yeah. Meredith.
I think it's kind of what people have been talking about, but when we talk about the economic inequality, also that there's a feeling of justification. That, you know, if we're not at the bottom, that's because we did something right, and those at the bottom done something wrong, so that the economic inequality doesn't bother a lot of people.
That, again, my language may not carry it very well, but that's my shorthand. where there are economic gaps or opportunity gaps or achievement gaps, it's because somebody did right and somebody did wrong. And so if you've been successful, that's the justification of your zooming ahead. Okay, I think there were some more in the middle. Back in the back.
How about this radical faith in markets? In other words, markets are the solution to life, right? Or certainly to healthcare. Markets are, have been touted as one solution to that.
I'll call that, for me, market driven. If you get the pen, you get to editorialize. Learn that from Jason. Market-driven realities, because it's always the market this, the market that. Okay, some other things that ail us.
I think it's a lack of accountability for our leaders. We no longer hold them accountable. And the language that they use, obstructionism instead of compromise, is hurting all of us.
Okay. Ron and then Jason.
Worship of technology.
Say a little bit more about what you mean by worship.
Well, I mean, sort of idolatry in the sense that we are not critical enough about new technological developments and assume that new things are good things uncritically.
And again, this isn't 2017. Isn't the first decade, first year in which people said that would be on the horizon for us. Jason,
please. I would say despair, and it's related to economic inequality and justified success and scarcity mentality, that especially in parts of the South and Appalachia where they believe there is no way forward.
Yeah, kind of broken.
Which leads to both economic despair and things like the opioid crisis.
Yeah. This is good. We're going to, how many more people have? I see Nancy, I see Chuck. Okay, we're going to do two more, and then we're going to switch gears with this really rich list. Nancy, what would you add?
Lack of imagination.
Lack of imagination.
None.
No. No.
No imagination.
Imagine. Which is why we are all here having our imagination refueled. Chuck, you get the last challenge for today.
Oh, my goodness. Well, maybe it's all mixed up with a lot of these, but you hear the expression post-truth era.
Mm-hmm.
And where the truth, in reporting into all sorts of places, doesn't seem to matter at all.
My the most scientifically astute member of my family is a nephew who is an astrophysicist. He lives in Boulder, Colorado. He does something having to do with sunspots way beyond me. Colorado is also the home of a big flat earth movement. He ponders how this can be. And again, I don't know any of the flat earth proponents. Evidently, they're denying gravity as well. But there's a point at which we might reach some agreement about basics that would be there. But I think, Chuck, you've said there is a lot less agreement because there can be a movement, the flat earth movement,
well,
it's doing that.
All of those things have some kind of disregard for truth.
Right. What the truth, even if it would be truth plural, there's a lot of going against truth. Now, here's what I'm going to see if I can get you to do. 5 minutes for you to talk to one or two people near you, so in a small group, about how one or more of these actually impacts something back in your home place. So take it local. You won't be able to do all of these, but talk, and if you're living up for a year at Holden, I guess you can talk about Holden as your home place, if you're here for a stretch of time. How do you see these being a reality locally? So 5 minutes on that, and then we're gonna share those local stories that will put a lot more flesh and bone on these challenges that we've named up here. Okay? Good. Turn towards somebody. Turn away. If you don't want to talk to the person you walked in the door with, turn the other way. There are many people, or move across the room. Okay, welcome back to the fireside room. And may some of those conversations continue at dinner, because they have a lively, I can tell from where I stand, they have a liveliness. Who can name a specific local issue reality back in your home place? Please.
I'm from Texas, Dallas-Fort Worth area, and we were talking about income inequality.
Yep.
In Texas, we don't have a state board of education, so the schools are funded by the local tax
company. Uh-huh.
And out where I live, where they're talking about buying computers for the kids so they no longer have to carry textbooks and have great education and any resource you could ever imagine, 30 miles in South Fort Worth, where the income, the properties are lower in value, they get less tax dollars, they can't even afford to buy textbooks for all the kids. Yep. So there's huge disparity.
Thank you for a very, very concrete example that I think would be true in many parts of the country. If we peel back one part of the story, economic inequality, it turns then into what the school, the public school experience is, depending on which community you're living in. Mm-hmm. Great. For naming a really important local issue. Who has another one you could share with us, a local issue? Carol.
This is related to the sort of market-driven approaches to everything. This is a national phenomenon, but just looking at the impact in our community, you know, we expect, you know, markets to solve problems of housing and healthcare, and they can't. And so we have, you know, our housing affordability it's just becoming increasingly out of reach of you know, lower income people, and homelessness is rising as a result, and people are having to live really, really far away from their jobs. And we're just looking at the breakdown of healthcare and even Obamacare. I think my own feeling is that markets cannot fix the healthcare system to provide quality healthcare for all in this country through private markets. And I just think we're seeing that, and we see that local level and
or the housing.
Yeah. Either, you know, both their social needs and it's and things are getting worse because
so probably across the country, others of us could say, yep, those same issues surface where we live back home, too. Some other issues.
We're representing Minot, North Dakota, and Sacramento, California.
Okay.
So we're looking to see what might be common and settled on boundaries, like ideal for Minot folks. Black Lives Matter is a really offensive term. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to say all lives matter.
Yeah.
Don't get white privilege. We had the Standing Rock thing where they were on the police side and not on the protesters' side. Sacramento would support the wall, you know, for Mexican immigrants or to keep out South, you know, from Central America, even though it's an economic importance, you know, all the workers that come up. You know, North Dakota is really anti-refugees, so they would have been supportive of that ban.
I'm going to make that anti-immigrant since because of some of the borders, they're not necessarily refugees, but immigrants. You catch that? In two very different parts of the country, we better draw the lines right here, with an outside group saying, no, you're not paying attention to who we are.
Just to dovetail this with the last one, ironically, it's an inversion of the attitude toward the market, right? Because every advanced society needs more workers, and they always are reaching, and the market demands more workers, and so there's this giant sucking sound in the demand for more labor, and yet that gets turned on its head, and we build a wall.
So we have both huge personal passion around issues that may not actually square with a market, with an economic viewpoint. I live in Minnesota, where there are a high number of immigrants, and we actually depend upon them economically, and yet some of the same drawing the borders, securing the borders, who who's in, who's out, what language can be used. Same thing, side by side, and I know that's true for others of you across the country. A couple of other local issues, please, in the back.
Well, this is California, Missoula, Montana, and Portland, Oregon. So, homelessness.
I'm sorry?
Homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
Is economic inequality. And how it's being dealt with, and some of, well, in Portland and in Missoula, there are churches stepping in to help homeless families have a place to stay, have meals to eat, and then help them transition. It takes a while to transition into a way that the government can help them out.
Thank you. How many of you, this is by a show of hands, would say back where you live most of your life, homelessness, particularly homeless families, are an issue? Yeah. And not unrelated to lack of affordable housing. Many, at least in my work with homeless families, many are employed, but they don't make a wage that would allow them to move into the available housing there. Okay, one more local issue, because this is really important stuff. Anybody else with a local issue?
We talked about the worship of technology and being causing people's lack of ability to talk, communicate, have a conversation, and be present, and that can lead to many other things.
You'll let me get away with it calling non-communication. I think it's more nuanced than that. Thank you for naming some local issues. If you'd keep that going in your mind, we're going to come back around to that, but we're going to take a look at one more of the resources in the packet. If you could find the one, the single page that's an excerpt from Miroslav Volf's Public Faith, How Followers of Christ Should Serve the Common Good. Miroslav Volf is a Serbian Christian. He now teaches at Yale. He's one of the leading interreligious voices in this country. And he was kind enough to allow me to type one page from his book, meaning I didn't ask, but I sat down and typed and credited him. I think proportionality, you get away with one page. But there are two, I'm the typist, and there are two corrections I want you to make on the handout. In number three, it should actually read, when it comes to life in the world, in that very first line, when it comes to life in the world, his third point will make a lot more sense if you get that corrected. And then number six, at the bottom of the page, the very last line on the page, should read like this. Ought to embrace pluralism. Ought, O-U-G-H-T. I was close on what I typed. All right, what I want us to do is we're gonna look at a couple of these statements. If they intrigue you, they are from a book, they're from the introduction to the book where he outlines what he's gonna cover in each of the chapters. And if these themes resonate with your own life, your own thinking, and you'd like to delve deeper, he will be very pleased if you buy a copy of Public Faith. If I could invite one of you to read statement number one on this sheet, and as you do that, for those of you who've been in a couple of sessions, think about Niebuhr. Think about that chart of different ways of relating faith and the public realm or culture. Who would read number one on that sheet for us? Oh, thank you, Janet.
Christ is God's word and God's lamb. Come into the world for the good of all people, who are all God's creatures and loved by God. Christian faith is therefore a prophetic faith that seeks to mend the world, an idle or redundant faith, a faith that does not seek to mend the world, is a seriously malfunctioning faith. Faith should be active in all spheres of life, education and the arts, business and politics, communication and entertainment, and more.
Thank you. For those of you who had a little chance to see the Niebuhr chart, what would Wolf rule out? There was one of those postures toward the wider culture that Niebuhr said some people embodied, and Wolf would say it just doesn't count, it's not legit. Anybody make sense of that?
Were there separate cultures, faith, and...
Yeah, where you just, we used an example, medieval monasticism. Another example might be the Amish, where you just say, we're going to be over here, the culture is too dangerous. So Wolf's perspective is to say, you can't, that's a cop-out, that's an idle faith, you can't go there. He puts us somewhere, puts himself in the middle of the chart. Let's go down to number three. Who would read that for us? Please.
When it comes to life in the world, to follow Christ means to care for others, as well as for oneself, and work toward their flourishing, so that life would go well for all, and so that all would learn in how to live their lives as well. A vision of human flourishing and the common good is the main thing the Christian faith brings into the public.
Thank you. Isn't that a wonderful word? Flourishing. His subsequent book is called Flourishing. Wish I had thought it up. Thinking back to these local issues, maybe we could start with the one about the disparities in the two school districts. What would it mean for all school children to flourish? So sharing resources, equal access to things like those cool computers that would move you beyond textbooks. And
adequate
funding for it, for flourishing. And I think, Carol, because you named healthcare and housing, again, to flourish by having a safe place to live and access to the healthcare that we all need from time to time, to flourish would mean to have that access.
For Bill. Children and people not to be homeless, to flourish helps everybody.
Yeah.
Everyone.
Bill's drawn us to homelessness. What's the reality, if you've known either single adults or homeless families, what's life like? Anybody work in a position where you've come to know some families? What do you know about homelessness?
It's chaotic, and it's driven by crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a huge struggle. So much of your energy is spent surviving and navigating and learning a lot of the people we help at our church are immigrants, and so much of their energy is spent surviving that they just...
Well, even not even just surviving yet, but sometimes it's the struggle just to find a place where you can get a shower, a place where you can, you won't be thrown out if you park your car, or, you know, things like that.
The basic needs. And in some ways, some of the same daily stresses for those who are homeless and those who are recent immigrants trying to navigate new language, new culture, new homeland. Think about the little children up here. I think of them as free-range children up here. And there's not a one who knows where I live. They don't wake me in the middle of the night. They don't get up at 5 and want me to play. Some of you know that reality. Don't they flourish in this village? They know there is a structure for them here, but they know there's a lot of love. There are opportunities for them to be a part of the larger community, and I just will keep this whole coming year that image of what children flourishing looks like in contrast to times that they're not flourishing.
They also don't have to worry about food.
Right.
One little boy was walking around and he said, oh, I don't know where my parents are.
But somebody will find them for you. Yeah. Yeah. So flourishing. What would it mean to flourish in with regard to some of these other local issues that are up here? Please.
Living without shame, which is homelessness, is, I think, shameful.
Yeah. Or back on the chart that I erased, the word despair, where one has enough well-being to be sturdy in inside one's own skin, I guess, I would say, so flourishing. So now we're seeing a little bit more of Wolf's proposal. His proposal doesn't need to be yours. It's just so easy to bring him along on this trip and say, you've outlined things for us. So let's look at a couple more of what he said. If somebody would read number 4.
Read it.
Thank you.
Since the world is God's creation, and since the Word came to his own, even if his own did not accept him, John 1:11, the proper stance of Christians toward the larger culture cannot be that of unmitigated opposition or whole-scale transformation. A much more complex attitude is required. that of accepting, rejecting, learning from, transforming, and subverting or putting to better uses various elements of an internally differentiated and rapidly changing culture.
Okay, it's kind of a thick read, this book. Carol, thank you for getting us through number four. What do you hear Wolf saying, and also does it provoke you? Do you buy his argument?
I think it calls for flexibility, for constantly struggling and not black-white.
Mm-hmm.
Embracing the gray.
Mm-hmm. Please.
Conversations, and I really like this quote. I think there's a lot of truth to that. But conversations about not being black and white, I think, really turn into, in the current context, conversations about truth and having alternative mm-hmm. truth and alternative facts and people wanting to see things as black and white and not being willing to live in that grayer area of uncertainty. But also just to problematize his statement a little bit, how then do you relate principles and your faith, and what do you not budge on, what do you decide to budge on mm-hmm. in order to have some sort of progress?
Please.
It shows a great deal of trust that the community can discern, or individuals can discern, or communities can discern together when to reject things and when to accept things. In a time when I think people want we reject this list, this is always the list we reject, and we never accept this list.
Yeah, so it's those of you who lifted up the word inability to compromise, this would be a strategy that calls for great gracefulness in knowing when to compromise and around what. Carolyn, then right here.
I think, though, I can't, in our present political context, really accept the idea that our attitude toward larger culture cannot be that of unmitigated opposition or whole-scale transformation. Part of me accepts that, but I think it's... I personally find it too tame for the current context that we're in. Although I think one has to look at this like every day, I would never want to be in a place of unmitigated opposition for years and not reflect on it. But I think there are times that may call for decision that no, this takes unmitigated opposition, like to Islamophobia,
yeah.
Or that I'm going to have unmitigated opposition to that. I'm not going to compromise with Islamophobia, as an example.
Yeah,
so.
And very fair. Thank you for also getting your own viewpoint out here. I will say of Wolf, he wrote this several years ago, so would he say it quite the same today? But very fair. Please.
One of the things that this makes me think about is one of the issues, I think, is everything we put on that first list, a lot of our problems are extremely complicated and complex. And simple, black and white, throwing things out isn't going to work. We need nuanced, creative, reflective, curious, brave exploration, as opposed to blanket, either I'm 100% in or I'm 100% out. It's much more nuanced than that, and we need a lot of brain power and bravery to take on those issues.
Yeah. And in some ways, personal coalitions where people might have more than one strategy, but linking arms to do it together. I want to have us listen to one more, if somebody would read number five.
Jesus Christ is described in the New Testament as a faithful witness, and his followers understood themselves as witnesses. The way Christians work toward human flourishing is not by imposing on others their vision of human flourishing and the common good, but by bearing witness to Christ, who embodies the good life.
Okay, now I hope he's provoking almost everybody here. What do you make of his claim? Do you buy it? Does it surprise you? What's your response to this, that there cannot be a singular Christian agenda that kind of plows through, even on things like homelessness. Please.
It gets back to what I just said about how complicated it is, and we should not be making assumptions which make asses out of you and me.
If we are trusting God to give us solutions, we have to trust that He has a better picture of what the final outcome is going to be than we do, and how we can get there.
What about the identity of witness? Most literature I read doesn't get right away to saying we're called to be witnesses. What would that be like? Could you imagine that in your own life? Please.
I think part of that relates back to what Carl said. I'm all for compromise and I'm all for flexibility, but when you stare evil in the eye, not to call it evil, miss the mission, to miss our mission.
Yeah.
I react to this, and I'm an activist. Mm-hmm. I'm an advocate, I'm an activist, mm-hmm. Also a pastor. I'm a little suspicious, and I have to say, I would want to know how this looks embodied. You know, what does that witness mean to him? If I just read it like this, and it's, you know, talking about Jesus, it doesn't cut it for me. I mean, I'm being really, you know, out there, but I mean, because human flourishing, a question for me too, interreligiously, is like, to make, what does Christ mean to him? You know, how does this get played out in our, you know, coalitions with Jews and Muslims and Buddhists, mm-hmm. and Sikhs, and for the human flourishing of all? And so I want to hear more about that.
And you see some danger, you see some shadows around it, that it may be a hugely compromised perspective. I hope Holden will invite Wolf to come, and then you can all ask him for himself what it means. Please.
In here where it says, toward human flourishing, it is not by imposing on others the vision of human flourishing. Isn't that what we're doing today? And isn't that why we have such polarized positions, is we're trying to impose our views on other people? I mean, I grew up in Spokane, Washington, pretty liberal place. I moved to Texas, pretty conservative place. And before I moved, I had this vision of conservatives and what, mm-hmm. they were. Since I lived down there, I've totally changed my view, because conservatives have their position for reasons, you know? And it's not a bad thing that they're conservative, mm-hmm. it's not a bad thing that we're liberal, but we're trying now to impose what we feel on each other. Mm-hmm. And so we end up, if I were to come out and say, I'm a conservative, automatically, liberals will look at me and say, wow, I can't believe he believes that way. And that's not the way it should be in this country.
Yeah.
You know?
Please.
I think what Carol's saying, or you, is that the looking evil in the face, or we have to be, there shouldn't be any compromise to being against homelessness. That doesn't mean that as we work towards a solution, that we're all going to agree, or that it's going to be...
On the strategies.
Strategies. Yep. But they can be very different things. I mean, if someone says, well, I'm sort of against homelessness, to me that is not where I am, and I think that is to be suspect. But to say that, you know, one way or the other, I mean, that can be a slippery slope too, but I think strategies and solutions are different than the actual quality or the concern.
I think it's also, my sense here is that it's also very personal. Something that has stuck with me, it's not been a solution to anything. I simply mean it has stuck with me. I was on the treadmill at the Y, watching news out of Charleston, South Carolina, when in the preliminary hearing, family member after family member rose and said to Dylann Roof, I forgive you.
Mind-blowing.
I think that might be the kind of witness of courage. He's a man who lived through a civil war that he's talking about when he says witness. And there have been very wise essays written about the meaning of that for the families who spoke and said that. There's also been a whole judicial process. There are many, many layers to that. I would never want to impose on anyone other than myself, the provocative nature of that witness, would I be able to stand up and say, I forgive in those circumstances? So we have witness that could be, that's one of those religious terms that can also be made small and kind of hokey, at least for hold nights, kind of hokey. But it could also be as grand as that courtroom and unexpected. But I want to go to Bill and then up here if there's another comment.
But
please.
Just real briefly, this conversation is surprisingly making me uncomfortable.
Okay.
If you look at the fears that we listed and we look mm-hmm. at the local realities, and without the specific solution, anyone can say, let's make America great again.
Sure.
I mean, and we could be in the same room with people that supported mm-hmm. our current mm-hmm. president, and they'd probably say the same things in a little different mm-hmm. way. Say, let's make it. We have to be really, I think, much more embodied in what we're saying.
So to move into our resistance.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Let me see if there's one or two more comments, and then we're going to do just that. And thank you for saying that it could, I think, the uncomfortable. Ness for any of us might be that we do nothing, we squander an opportunity and not really going deep into something.
It's nice to sit here and list those things.
Yeah.
People who supported our current president say,
yeah. What are you going to do? Yeah.
Something just happened in 5 minutes.
Yeah. Was there a comment over here? Okay. The last comment here.
I can add this. I heard the saying, and I think it's apropos. The lips move, but the feet have to shuffle.
Mm-hmm.
You can witness,
yeah.
But then I think you need to get your back off the couch and do something about that.
Yeah. And I think because I've read more of Wolf, he means the whole embodied life of witness rather than just the mouth going and no platitudes. But you read the book and check that out. We're going to do two more exercises, and one or two of you told me you need to leave early, and you're allowed to leave early. But the first exercise, Carol's already thrown out a couple of descriptions of herself. You said, I'm an activist. I'm an advocate. I'm a pastor. She threw out three of them. Boom, 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 like that. Let's talk about, if you're willing to share in this group, what's the title you put on the way you see your own vocation vis-a-vis public life? We've got one activist advocate. Are there some other people who have a kind of title you operate by for your public vocation?
I'm a business owner.
Okay.
We run a marketing company.
So you come at public life. Are you in like Chamber of Commerce or do you sit with other business people? Or?
Chamber of Commerce, member of the Rotary.
Yep. So in some ways you found a way in the community to be living out your vocation there in the business community. Okay, how about some other descriptors? Anybody a gadfly? Anybody a provocateur? I'm so happy that the ones back in St. Paul can't reach me this week.
I would say in my public life, I'm a school secretary, so I'm kind of a mom, a mothering mm-hmm. figure to a community mm-hmm. there. And with children, teachers, mm-hmm. and parents. And then in my church life, which I consider my other realm, mm-hmm. my other primary realm, I'm a kind of, I would say, a catalyst.
A catalyst, okay. Let's go for some more descriptions like that. It can be related to the work you do, but it can also be the energy you bring in this time of resistance. Anybody else?
I don't have like one great word, but in both my work life as a journalist and in my life in my congregation, I try to be the person who says, this is the important thing to think about. Mm-hmm. These other things are not important to think about. This is the important thing.
Let's think of a single word and help Jason out. What would we call that? The person who says, here's where we're headed. This is the most, what do we call that person? You're a discerner? Okay. Clarifier, prophet.
Focuser, that's not a real word, but you know.
It's okay. Yeah.
Distiller.
You liking this?
Distiller.
See, you're going to go home with, you know, a new title on the door. Okay. Anybody else have a word to describe their own posture toward the public realm? Please.
I think I'm frustrated that I don't have a term.
Ah. So that's going to be some of your soul work. Is to, you have tonight, tomorrow, the next day, figure out, what am I? Please.
Connector.
What do you mean by that?
Like I joined an indivisible group, and then I've been going to, you know, a conference here and a workshop here, and I bring back information and ideas, and, you know, also trying to look at maybe a little more broadly, bring that artistic perspective also. So I'm not going to be the one that's saying, okay, we need to just go this way. I'm going to be the one saying, well, you know, geology ties in with this, and transportation ties in with this, and, you know, here's some info from different areas, and then we need to work together to... I'm also an urban planner by background, so that was my professional training, which I quit practicing a long time ago, but those skills, that synthesizing and translating... You know, we all use our own professional jargon, and if you translate it for other people so that they say, oh, this is what you mean.
So a connector, a translator, a complexifier. Okay. Anybody else want to share who you are? What's your identity?
An advocate, work in the creation care area, and a demonstrator, but that's a different kind of demonstrator.
Do you mean with the signs, demonstrator?
No, not with the sign. Maybe the sign is... So our house is solar powered and whatever.
Oh, okay.
So being an example and hopefully a role model and try and demonstrate those ways which solutions can be found.
So people who know you can come and see
right,
what you're talking about, what it looks like in a whole household. Okay, good. Who else has come up with a description for themselves? Please.
Well, I'm retired from teaching.
Okay. Okay, a worker bee. Great. We're going to do one one more person has a, what's come to mind? What's your descriptor?
Well, I sort of have two lives, okay, in the public wheel. And one is I'm a teacher, and I teach about American politics, California politics, electoral politics. I do that. And in that world, it's not that it's value-free. I don't mean that at all. It's not neutral. But it is subdued. I mean, I don't, you know, I think I... compromise myself if I make decisions for students about how they should feel about these issues. But the other part of me is I'm a partisan. You know, I believe in parties and I believe in politics. And I get involved.
So you show up. What state are you from?
California.
So do they have caucuses or
no,
what kind
not.
Of parties?
Yeah.
Come out to you. Come out to Minnesota. There
yeah,
where it's unlike. So okay. Thank you. And if you don't yet have your word. Keep praying that that comes to you or help each other find that word. And the more it's a made-up word, I think even better in these times. We're going to do one more activity. I'm going to ask you to turn toward one or two of your neighbors. 3 minutes, one concrete step you're willing to take in your home place. One concrete step. It can be a huge step. You were just waiting for the courage. Now you've been to Holden and you have the courage, or maybe it's just this big, but it's the next right thing you are going to do to live out your heartfelt vocation in a time of resistance. 3 minutes. I'll call you back together. All right, you activists, advocates, politicos, distillers, teachers, business leaders, all the other descriptors. Who's willing to share the one next step, right step you're going to take back home? Anybody bold enough to share what it is? Please.
So part of why I came up here was to meet with Chuck and Peg and learn more on community art, and that's a piece that they're doing a workshop next week that we've already talked about that I want to take back in my indivisible group about doing some community art and trying to draw people in.
Okay, and next right step, then it fits with what you said about your being a connector. Anybody else willing to share what your next right step is? Please.
And I'll tie this back to the last descriptor word. I'm going to put my descriptor word as learner. I think I have a lot to learn. I've been decently involved, but still lots of things to definitely continue to figure out. And my vague conception of my vocation is to continue to enact social justice in interpersonally, on sort of a direct level. So next year, starting August 5th, I'm going to do Lutheran Volunteer Corps, and
okay.
I'll be working with refugee families to resettle families in Minneapolis. So I think that's pretty
good. I'll run into you.
Yeah,
right across the river. Good.
Yeah.
Great. Okay, and next right step for you. Anybody else know, have you, in 3 minutes, was that long enough to discern your next right step? I think the two people who spoke have been churning on that, chewing on that for a little while. Anybody else want to share? Please.
There's a number of things I'm doing now already related to the topics that we were talking about, but one of the things, and I don't know the answer to it yet, but one of the things I'm committed to finding a way to get connected to and more anti-racism work in my community. And I'm thinking about probably the easiest vehicle to do that is to join the local NAACP, which in our county, or in our small city, is the sort of the organization that seems to be doing the most on that.
So a next right step. Great. Anybody else? Please.
I think the reason that I said despair is that I as a journalist, we cover so many terrible, terrible things. It's a drumbeat of horror. And I spend some time, but I want to spend more time talking about stories of hope. Not that we're still going to do the terrible stuff, but there's got to be some hope or joy in some place in there. Otherwise, I don't know why people would keep listening or why people get out of bed at all.
Right. And not to soften Bill's point, I think, not to soften, but to also show that long view that the arc actually is headed in a direction. Anybody else?
Sharon and I belong to a large urban congregation that suffers from what, of being part of a large urban congregation with very few African Americans, a fair amount of ethnic heterogeneity, but very, very few African Americans. Mm-hmm. But we came into a situation where sort of fell into our laps. A Lutheran congregation went out of business, basically, located in an African-American neighborhood in Sacramento, and sort of deeded the property to us. And so we're in the process of arranging property transfer over time to another sale property transfer to an African-American congregation that needs new building. And so it opens up all kinds of possibilities for our white church.
Mm-hmm.
To sort of partner with the African American Church in Dan. And we've done it corporately, but we need to do it individually too.
And somebody, I speak out of the bishop's office right now, somebody has to dog all those details. There are a lot of relationships to be built and meetings to be had and things to happen. So that's going to be your next right step. Okay, I'm going to invite you to stand. And if you'd face the person or the people you were just in discussion with, and if you don't know their name, if you would find out their name or names. My vocation is a trickster because I'm in I now have you really on your feet on the spot for to do a little liturgy. I'm going to do a phrase, and I would ask you to repeat it, looking at the person. Or some of you are in threes. I'll go slow enough. You can look at each other. Okay, here we go. God of power.
God of faithfulness.
Give, and here say the name or names of the people across from you.
Grace and courage.
To live out their convictions. Amen. Friends, you've been blessed. That's it. Thanks for being a part of this.
Thank you.